Hey, this is Mark Stein. This Saturday, I'll be celebrating Duke Ellington and the biggest hits ever to come out of Denmark and South Africa. Plus, Sinatra in short trousers and Ah, Sweet Mystery of Life. Ah, indeed. Ah, on the town. Saturday at 5 on Serenade Radio.
The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now. Here's Mark.
Hey, welcome along. May 22nd, 2024. It is 3 p.m. North American Eastern Time, 4 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, 4:30 p.m. in fabulous Newfoundland, and beyond the Americas, 8 p.m. in London, where they're gripped by election fever, 9 p.m. in Tirana, where the Albanian government and put out some truly spectacular bunting for David Cameron, only to find the British Foreign Secretary had to scurry back to Downing Street to sign off at the pre-election cabinet meeting. 10 p.m. in I just can't do that anymore. We're going back to Kiev. 10 p.m. in Kiev, where there is to be no election. 10:30 p.m. in Tehran, where today rather fewer citizens than might have been expected turned out for their president's memorial following his unexpected hard landing. Midnight 45 in Kathmandu for all you Iranians who moved to Nepal to see whether you have hard landings on the quarter hour time zone. 3 a.m. in Singapore and Honkers, 5 a.m. in Sydney and Melbourne, 7 a.m. in Auckland, and a rather more convivial hour for the Kippers and Kedgeri in His Majesty's dominions across the Pacific. Still having a few voice problems, but I will endeavour to stagger through to the end of the hour. This month is the 7th birthday of the Mark Stein Club, and I thank all those first fortnight founding members who've decided to re-up for an 8th year, and I certainly hope that our first month members will want to do the same in the coming days. Thank you also to those of you who've signed up a chum for a Mark Stein Club gift membership. I hope they're still speaking to you. We have sort of breaking news from London, where Rishi Rich, a few hours ago, asked the King to dissolve Parliament. And so a general election will be held on the 4th of July. Tory MPs are not happy about it. Into the Valley of Death rode the 344. Just to kick off the campaign, the way it's likely to go on, Rishi gave one of the most hilariously awful announcements by a head of government I have ever seen. He stood at the lectern in Downing Street during what started as a light rain. He was in a light grey suit, and he was absolutely sodden as the speech went on. Sodden Sunak. And as he began speaking, a ghetto blaster in the general vicinity began blasting out Tony Blair's 1997 campaign anthem, "Things Can Only Get Better." Not for Rishi, things can only get wetter. At least Boris would have been able to improvise a joke about it. And if he found himself competing with Tony Blair's stupid song, he would have at least had some shtick about, no, it's time for Keir Starmer to face the music or whatever. But not Sodden Sunak, who, as the Niagara cascaded off his shoulders and the music got loud, he just carried on with his absolutely terrible speech. So the takeaway is that he's a loser who can't even stage a short announcement without communicating that he is a total loser. The problem, I want this party punished because they had 14 years in government and they have, and the result of that is that conservatism in Britain is virtually non-existent. They haven't conserved anything. They've all been modish twerps. David Cameron, Theresa May, Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, Rishi Sunak. There is no need for a Conservative Party that can do no better than this. But just being useless, just, you know, standing in the rain, it's beyond that. They actually betrayed their voters. They betrayed them twice. One was with Brexit. You know, David Cameron got head faked into calling a referendum that he expected to win. And because he's an arrogant, lazy sod, he assumed he was going to win it. And so on the morning after, the result came through at something of Brexit at 4:43 a.m., something like that. And at 7 o'clock, he came out of Downing Street and in a big queeny, flouncy huff said, "Right, that's it. You didn't do what I told you to do, so I'm off." And quit. What happened then was that people who claimed to be willing to implement what the British people had voted for in that referendum, like Theresa May, then betrayed them. The interesting thing is that you can blame Michel Barnier at the European Commission. You can blame the government in Dublin, which certainly leveraged the Irish border in a very clever way. But at heart, you have to, and you can blame all the other forces in the British establishment, like the civil service and the judges. But in the end, you also have to blame the Conservative and Unionist Party, which is neither. The Conservative and Unionist Party, which did not accept what its voters wanted. That was the first one. Then the second betrayal came in 2019 when Boris, whatever you feel about him, connected with people sufficiently to deliver an 80-seat majority for the Conservative Party. And then those awful people sitting on those Tory benches and sitting around the cabinet table in Downing Street, then utterly betrayed them. They've done nothing conservative. They've damaged conservatism, and they have to be punished for that. And doesn't matter, oh, Keir Starmer, oh, big, scary Labour bogeyman. No, he's not. He's just... It's for start, that's not going to work. I forget who it is who keeps calling him Starmageddon, which is kind of cute, but it's not going to take off because he's just bland and boring and unthreatening. And the fact of the matter is, when you look at the damage that this so-called fake-o Conservative Party, you know, you have to accept the next election's lost, so there's going to be a Labour government. So then what do you want to happen 5 years down the road? You want there to be a true Conservative Party, a true alternative to the way all the parties in Britain, including the stupid parties that actually want to leave the country, like Sinn Féin, they all agree on everything. So if you want a party that actually provides an alternative for voters, you're going to have to destroy this useless Conservative Party first. Okay, getting a little bit carried away there. What else is happening? And don't say, oh, but Labour will be worse. You're going to not have a Conservative Party in government on July the 5th. You have to accept that. So the question then is to set up conditions for next time round. And saving the Conservative Party, which on July the 5th will be even wetter and limper and more soft leftish than it is right now, oughtn't to be part of any serious Conservatives plan. What else is happening? Well, it's 2 weeks and 6 days until the landmark case, The King on the Application of Mark Stein versus the Office of Communications, comes to the High Court of England at the Royal Courts of Justice in the Strand. That's about 100 yards from Australia House. So if any of our Antipodean listeners are going to be in London, I would love to see you. But maybe you'll all be out stumping for Rishi Rich. What else? Oh, yeah, 150 years ago, this very day, May 22nd, 1874, Verdi's Requiem was performed for the very first time at the Church of San Marco in Milan to mark the first anniversary of the death of the great Italian writer Alessandro Manzoni. Maybe we'll do his novel The Betrothed for Tales for Our Time. Or maybe on July the 5th, we'll actually perform Verdi's Requiem for Rishi Rich's premiership. No Verdi on today's show. No Charles Aznavour, by the way. He was born 100 years ago today. Because we saluted Monsieur Aznavour on our new Saturday show at Serenade Radio. We moved all the music to the weekend because people thought it was a distraction from talking about the really important stuff like Mitch McConnell. So now we can talk about Mitch McConnell nonstop. Isn't that a thrill? Alyssa Angel says, does Rishi Sunak, Elisa, I think she prefers it to be pronounced. Elisa Angel says, does Rishi Sunak not own an umbrella or have the good sense to go inside out of the rain? Yeah. What's interesting is that he doesn't have the kind of staff of the size that, you know, some no-name American congressman would have, but he does have a staff, and I'm sure somewhere in number 10 there's a number 10 Downing Street. I'm sure somewhere in 10 Downing Street there is an umbrella, and you would have thought that someone could have used a little bit of initiative, and maybe once it became clear that the rain was showing on camera and that nobody was listening to anything Rishi said because they were instead marvelling at how his handmade suit was getting soaked. And actually, with the amount of water, that's going to shrink. So maybe even by now, too small even for dinky little Rishi to get into. But you would have thought that someone would have come rushing out and done that. Some staffer just helpfully providing an umbrella, stood there, and or he could have held his own umbrella, like the Queen used to do. But instead he thought it was a good look for the takeaway of his announcement, is that he's a prat who gets soaked in the rain while some guy is blasting the Labour Party's theme tune at him. So the thing about many Western nations right now is that nothing works. And you think the leaden rituals of politics. You know the way it is when you see some candidate, like the American thing where he comes out to give some completely inconsequential announcement, but he's standing in front of, you know, 157 of the biggest American flags you ever saw. A bit like actually Keir Starmer, who had two Union Jacks when he responded to Rishi, which is two more Union Jacks than Jeremy Corbyn would ever be seen with. You'd think, you know, okay, politicians can't enforce the border, they can't do anything about crime, but at least they're leaden rituals. The leaden rituals of the political dinner party theatre, at least they can do that. Well, Rishi Sunak demonstrated, and his staffers demonstrated today, they couldn't even do that. Just extraordinary, actually, and really, truly pitiful in some sense. Robert Norris says, Mark, I find it hard to have much hope for the UK, the land of the Equality Act, online harms laws, mass immigration, putrid outgoing Tories, and of course Ofcom. Your upcoming fight with Ofcom will be a show of backbone that it seems only a foreigner could muster in this country. Do you fear this may be a flash in the pan for liberty before the night inevitably falls. Well, I don't regard myself as a foreigner, Robert, and nor does British law, in which Commonwealth citizens supposedly enjoy the same rights as UK citizens. So, you know, if I were minded to move back there, I could vote in elections as a Canadian, and I could sit in the cabinet as a Canadian. And as you'll know, when I was on GB News, I used to say, all these guys are useless. There is no talent in the modern Tory party. So because Canadians and Commonwealth citizens can sit in the cabinet, let's get Tony Abbott. Let's buy Tony Abbott a drink and talk Tony Abbott into becoming the leader of the UK Conservative Party. And in fact, I bumped into Tony and he rather liked it, the idea of that. I also ran it by Maxime Bernier because I think it would be funny for the second Canadian Prime Minister of the United Kingdom after Bonner Law to be a Quebecer. And Maxime seemed tickled by it too. I am feeling foreign in large parts of that country after those elections the other week, when you say, oh, I wonder, let me just have a look and see what's happened in that Yorkshire Council election. And there's a guy there in the full Islamic get-up shouting Allahu Akbar because of his tremendous victory. And then there's another guy, they also in the Islamic get-up, which is weird in a way, because it's a form of clothing that was basically designed for the Arabian desert that's now being worn in northern England. And to me, I thought that was sad. And the question I posed somewhere or other the other day is, here's the thing, on the present course, are there going to be more or fewer constituencies where there are candidates in Arabic garb shouting Allahu Akbar? And we all know the answer to that. So I think the UK is finished. And I think it's interesting when you read pieces by so-called Tories that they have implicitly accepted what's going to happen. And it's all about identifying elements now in the Muslim community in multicultural Britain that they can talk into coming on side with them. But the preservation of Britain, the preservation of the authentic culture of those islands, is not a priority with any of them. And again, it's a line I often use. When you lose your future, you also lose your past. I think I first referenced this when a theatre that I'd been to a couple of times in Vancouver announced it was closing down, because they used to do, you know, Noel Coward plays and Terence Rattigan. And then what happened was that, strictly for the money, after Hong Kong went back to the Chinese, a whole ton of Hong Kong gazillionaires all hopped on a plane to Vancouver and bought up all the property. And there simply isn't an audience now who wants to see the kind of plays that theatre put on. You know, it applies to other things too. There's not going to be, when you become a semi-Islamic country, if you like, I know I'm a bit of a, regarded as a bit of a Nancy boy by some of you boomer rock types. But yeah, there's not going to be a lot of classic rock, or whatever you call it, guitar-driven rock, once a country becomes semi-Islamic, because they don't go for that. So you not only lose your future, but you lose your past. And what has happened? Again, it's betrayal. What people voted for in Brexit was to take back control of the borders. And instead, Cameron, useless. Lady May, useless. Who's the next one? Johnson, useless. Ms. Truss, useless. And now Sunak, useless. They just opened the borders. They have to be punished for that. Don't go on, say, oh, this is great. What I love about democracy is you have a choice between Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer. No, 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 no. That's not going to do anything for you. They're in agreement on everything. It's a pantomime horse with two rear ends. Right-wing Nigel writes, is Rishi Sunak insane, asking for a friend? Well, a lot of his caucus seem to think that. The Conservative MP, I've heard from, you know, a couple of heavyweight Tories in the hours since this announcement was made, who think that, I heard from a member of the House of Lords and whatnot, and they think he's gone absolutely crazy. And the interesting thing is that there's enough people complaining to the Backbench 1922 committee, which basically runs the Tory leadership process, thinking that it might be it might be time to get. So Rishi's called the election, but if enough Tory members object, he could be deposed as leader before the election. And that would be very interesting. I'm not actually sure constitutionally. They don't agree with what he's done. They wanted him to go later in the year. And unfortunately, he did things in an order that they can't unravel it. If he'd sort of announced this if he'd actually done what does happen, he says, well, I've decided we need to have an election. So after I've given this speech, I'm going to be driven to the palace and ask the king to dissolve Parliament. If he'd done it in that order, they could, in theory, have overturned him and taken and prevented any dissolution of Parliament. But they're still able to get rid of him, and they might as well at this point. Why not? You know, it's not just that Rishi Sunak is insane, it's that the entire Conservative Party is institutionally insane. My friend John O'Sullivan said a quarter century ago now, after that fellow who was the Conservative MP who was found dead on his breakfast table with a satsuma and a tab of ecstasy in his mouth and two ladies' stockings on it. He was completely naked, except he was wearing two ladies' stockings on his legs and had a third stocking round his throat. And this was autoerotic asphyxiation, which nobody had really heard of before he did it to himself, but which within about 10 minutes of the poor chap's body being found, everyone was going, oh, yes, I know. There's a couple at number 27 who do it all the time. It was apparently, you know, incredibly common. But John O'Sullivan's point was that the modern Conservative Party was basically a collection of autoerotic asphyxiators, metaphorically speaking. And Rishi certainly has autoerotically asphyxiated his premiership tonight. Edward says, hello, Mark. Will Dr. Naomi Wolf be with you at the Strand in central London at the English High Court, as she was also chastised by Oxford for reporting facts in her Stein Online programme about the jab and the harms to unborn babies, asks Edward. Oh, yes. Naomi's going to be there at the High Court because she is an interested party, so-called. So she's been copied on everything, on all the filings. There are two interested parties. One is Naomi and the other is GB News. But as you know, GB News aren't that interested. Or they weren't that interested. I think they'll be watching it with rather more interest now, but I don't think they'll actually be turning up in court. Naomi is going to be in court and I look forward to seeing her. What is interesting to me is that every week that goes by, Naomi looks far saner on this issue than all the people that Ofcom don't bother chastising. Chris Davis says, Mark, following Klaus Schwab's decision to step down as executive chairman of the World Economic Forum, presumably you'll be dusting off your best Tony Blair impersonation soon. Just the vocals, you understand. No need to be invading a country whilst riffing off non-existent weapons of mass destruction. Look forward to seeing you in the Royal Courts of Justice to hand Ofcom their arse. We'll see about that. Re Tony Blair. I'm not sure this would be quite the gig for him. Also, the thing about, I think the reason Klaus Schwab is the, by the way, he's going to be continuing on as non-executive chairman of the World Economic Forum, although he says this change from job title, from being executive chairman to non-executive chairman, apparently requires the approval of the Swiss government, and I have no idea why that is. But I think I honestly think after Klaus Schwab's spectacular, he founded this thing in 1971, and now he gets invited to international summits. I mean, we used to, what was that? I think, where was it? Indonesia or something? It was the G20, I think it was. And they're all standing around in these Hawaiian shirts looking like Elvis did in Fun in Acapulco or whatever, as if he's about to take his guitar and go serenade Anne Margaret. And Klaus Schwab was there in exactly the same Hawaiian shirt as Joe Biden and Emmanuel Macron and all the rest of them. I don't know how that happened, but he made it happen. And the thing about it is it's so fantastic. As I always used to call him on GB News, the sinister Teutonic megalomaniac hiding in plain sight as a sinister Teutonic megalomaniac. You just can't beat that accent. You know, when he stood there and he goes, the future does not just happen. The future is made by a powerful group of people such as you in this room. And and just to make it more convincing, he actually shook his fist. He shook his fist. He went full Nuremberg. And so I don't think you can beat that. So even if Tony Blair, even if Tony Blair does get the job, I think it should be mandatory that he also has to adopt the sinister Teutonic megalomaniac accent. You know, Diana was not just a princess. She was the people's princess. Things can only get better, yeah. I mean, I think Tony needs to adopt that too. Peter says, greetings, Mark. As you've so aptly described, thanks to the efforts of open borders globalists, Europe is on its way to becoming an Islamic entity. Why would the white atheist WEF Schwabsters believe that they have a brilliant future in such an environment? Or is suicide the purpose? The one thing you notice, if you ever go to international confabs, and there was a point in the early years of this century that I used to get invited to them. But if you go to them, you know they don't think in those kinds of terms. They think about the elite. They think about the people who are flying in for the big globalist beano. And then they think of the masses. And they don't really, the way they look at it, I was thinking about this after John Kerry gave some commencement address where he told the people he was talking to that they're going to be living in a borderless world. And what he meant is that this was, I don't think it was Harvard, but it was some fancy college. What he meant was that those people are the kind of people who just go wherever they want. So, you know, they graduate from their university and they get a job with Goldman Sachs. And then Goldman Sachs says, hey, how would you like to go to the Singapore office for a couple of years? And after they've been at the Singapore office for a couple of years, then they maybe take a job with some UN agency in Geneva for 2 or 3 years. And then something else opens up. And the whole thing is, at that point, if you're one of these people who's just flying around to all this stuff, you divide the world into the people flying around in the private planes and the losers they're flying over. And they don't distinguish between those losers. So that a bunch of Irish losers are no different to them than from a bunch of Somali losers. I had the misfortune at one of these international conferences to sit next to Peter Sutherland, who was a big Euro grandee from Dublin. And, you know, yeah, I'm sure he could, if someone played When Irish Eyes Are Smiling, actually probably not that, because he was that's more for Irish Americans. But you could, if you'd have played some sentimental ballad, he would have faked being Irish for a bit, but he didn't. That's not who he was. He'd become part of the club. And so, and the other point to remember, Peter, is that in this club, the Islamic big shots are very big shots. So like Saudi princes you've never heard of, Gulf emirs you've never heard of, are at the World Economic Forum. And they're, you know, they're the sort of urbane, civilized, semi-westernized, amusing kind of Saudi princes. And so if you say Islamic or Muslim to any of those globalist guys, that's who they think, oh, Prince whatever was here the other day, he's perfectly charming. I don't know what you're making such a big fuss about. It's the division. The division isn't between Europeans and Muslims. It isn't. They don't think like that. They think the division is between them and the vast seething mass of losers far below them. That's how they think of these things, and that's the distinction that matters. It's kind of just gone 1:30 the hour. Let's pause a moment, unless of course you're in Newfoundland or Iran or Nepal, in which case I apologize, but it's 1:30 the hour for most of us. Let's pause from the passing Shari-Vari. As I said, all the music's moved to my new weekly show on Serenade Radio, 5 p.m. London time on Saturday. That's 12 midday North American Eastern. Mark Stein on the town. So we can now talk about who's 2 points up in Pennsylvania nonstop on this show. However, before we do that, I was struck by all these GB News guys reeling from Ofcom's latest decision against them, which this time in an escalation came with the threat of statutory sanctions. They've actually begun an investigation into what sanctions they're going to impose. So all the GB News guys, if you look at their Twitter feeds, are suddenly butching up, super, super, super butch, so butch they should be using Mark Levin's signature tune. That's how butch they've suddenly become. The Right Honourable Sir Jacob Rees-Mogg, the man who, as Lord President of Her Majesty's Privy Council, sat in the Cabinet and signed off on 3 years of COVID bollocks, the man who accepted a knighthood from disgraced Prime Ministerial flopperoo Boris Johnson, that Jacob Rees-Mogg is now talking like a revolutionary ready to storm the barricades. Likewise, Patrick Christie's, young chap, pleasant enough fellow, but someone who, if he had any self-respect, would not have stolen Dan Whoopton's entire show format. That's Dan's. Dan came up with it, and Patrick Christie's should not have stolen it. And there's Nigel, of course. After taking it from Dame Melanie and Ofcom for 18 months, these guys are suddenly now warriors for freedom. And by the way, have they actually done as I did when I got my Ofcom decisions and heard that GB News would not be appealing them? Have they called my learned friends and actually filed suit, or is it just their usual pseudo butchness? They've said today that they're taking Ofcom to court. Interestingly, yesterday was the deadline for GB News to make any submissions in my case. So they waited till that deadline had passed before announcing their legal action. And at some point, watching Patrick Christie's and Sir Jacob Rees-Mogg the phrase chocolate soldier popped into my head. It dates from the late 19th century. I think it was originally chocolate cream soldier. After Fry's chocolate cream, the first mass-produced chocolate bar. I haven't had one of those in decades, and now I've got a craving for it. It means chocolate cream soldier means a soldier who doesn't do any fighting but looks splendid in the full dress uniform. And it was greatly popularized by George Bernard Shaw in his play Arms and the Man. I think that's, 1894. Bernard Shaw left his estate to the Society of Authors in London, and back in happier times, I was literary advisor to the estate. If you wanted to turn one of its plays into a musical, you had to run it by me. Because Shaw had made a very foolish decision long ago with regard to Arms and the Man, which was turned into an operetta he loathed, The Chocolate Soldier, a smash hit in Vienna in 1908 and then worldwide. Anyway, here's the big take-home tune from the score. This is how my mind works these days. From Sir Jacob Rees-Mogg threatening Ofcom, to Fry's chocolate cream, to a lovely melody by Oscar Strauss. Here's Risa Stevens. Risa Stevens, My Hero, the big song from the smash operetta of 1908, The Chocolate Soldier, music by Oscar Strauss, words by Stanislaus Stanger. Such a lovely tune. Half a lifetime ago, I swung by the Prince Edward Theatre in London to see Bob Avian. who was a great choreographer, Promises, A Chorus Line, Miss Saigon. He produced Dream Girls. And he was in rehearsal there, and he was in the stalls and said, "Hi, Mark, what have you been doing?" And I said, "Oh, I've just seen a revival of The Chocolate Soldier." And he goes, "Oh, that's the one with my hero in it." And we both broke into an impromptu duet of it, which isn't easy if you're of a non-soprano bent. And about eight bars in, we noticed that the great impresario Cameron McIntosh had walked in and caught us at it and was staring at us with an absolutely aghast expression on his face. Beautiful song, even with me and Bob Avian doing it. More, I miss Bob. He died a year or two back, and he was a lovely man. More music on Saturday. He lived in that fancy part of Connecticut. What's that town called? Kent. I think his three closest neighbours were Patti LuPone, Stephen Sondheim, and Henry Kissinger. It's that kind of town. He said, "We've eliminated the middle classes too, so they have, everybody who does anything has to be bussed in from ever further away." More music on Saturday, and that's also actually relates to a lot of the problems that the world has, is that it's not like it was in America for much of American history, where the factory owner lives in the town where the factory is and marries his secretary. It's not like that anymore. The class divisions basically mean different groups in, it's not quite the difference between Davos and all the people at the bottom of the mountain, but it is getting close to that. More music on Saturday, more operetta as it happens. I know how many of the boomer rockers who listen to us are actually closet operetta fans. Mark Stein on the town, 5 p.m. London time on Serenade Radio. We're live around the planet. It's 19 to 4 North American Eastern Time. That is 19 to 9 British Summer Time. A little behind, a lot ahead, according to where you chance to be on this turbulent earth. Let us get back to your questions. Martin Everson says, "Hi, Mark, did you notice Liam Halligan is moving on from GB News? Another talent moving on. Do GB News fear those who are off narrative on interest rates too? Who is left? Less and less reason to watch. I wonder what you make of it." Well, Liam Halligan, he's not an ideological crazy like I am, or, you know, Calvin Robinson or Lawrence Fox or whatever. He was the money guy. He was a very respected money guy. So he was one of those figures like Colin Brazier who lent the station credibility, or Alastair Stewart. And if, in case you haven't noticed, all those people have now gone. I think it's one of the things is that they just kind of, you know, Liam Halligan is not someone like Patrick Christie's who will do a 6-hour show for, 12 shillings, thruppence halfpenny. You have to, when you have these are guys with real reputations that they built up before GB News. And you have to, not only pay them proper salaries, but you also have to have a professional operation. I watched a bit of GB News for the first time since GB News and I parted company, because one of the interesting questions about the election is whether Nigel Farage is going to cease doing his "she didn't say yes, she didn't say no" routine and actually decide to jump in and stand for a constituency in the UK election. So I was interested. So I watched Dubes and the start of Farage, who's been yanked from taken off air, interestingly, because I take it they don't want another Ofcom ruling against them. But I watched at 6 o'clock, right? And Michelle Dubery comes on and she says, hello. Hello. I love Michelle. She's got a fantastic voice. She's got a fantastic voice. I can't do it. I won't even try to do it because it's great when she does it. But anyway, Michelle comes on and she says, welcome to the show. And she immediately says, as you may know, just, 40 minutes ago, Rishi Sunak stood outside 10 Downing Street and said, and she tossed the clip of Rishi Sunak right at the start of the show, and it being the GB News control room, they couldn't play it. So she sat there looking blank for a few seconds. Now, this is the clip that is the clip of the day, Rishi announcing the election. It's not like the obscure stuff I used to, it's not like Debbie Reynolds going jabber, jabber, jabber. It's not like stuff that they, they couldn't play it. The GB News control room flopped out, couldn't play it. That was the start of Michelle's show. Then 7 o'clock, I tune in for the start of Nigel's show, and it's Tom Harwood hosting, and it opens with him mouthing silently because they haven't switched his microphone on. And then they do that GB News thing where, because nobody's paying attention, GB News control them, they're all ordering their sandwich. Oh, no, I thought, I didn't want the Branston pickle. I asked for the turkey with the, because they're all doing that, they're ordering that. It takes forever before they, he's just mouthing silently, and someone raises the fader that opens his microphone. So the reason, and this is after they've asked for voluntary redundancies, and it was oversubscribed. They only wanted 40 people to take redundancy. But there was a stampede. Because at least you're going to get some money now. When the thing collapses, you're not going to get anything. But the thing about it is, for Liam Halligan, if you're a professional broadcaster, at a certain point, you just get sick of the way. We improved on the Mark Steyn show because we took more and more things away from GB News's either incompetent or deliberately sabotaging control room. But I'd love to. I like Liam. I think he's got credibility. He's got gravitas. He's just a natural at it. And the fact that the fact that people like that don't want to be at GB News is actually more telling than the fact that they've gotten rid of nutters like me. Jamie Marshall says, Mark, living through the collapse of Western civilization in real time makes me appreciate all that much more those that contributed to it beforehand, which brings me to one in particular. I'm guessing he's not exactly your cup of tea, as I don't remember you mentioning him before. But what are your thoughts on J.R.R. Tolkien? Have you read The Lord of the Rings? I thought the movies were an abomination as they changed the story completely. What say you? I went to the same school as J.R.R. Tolkien. He was there a couple of years ahead of me, I think. And I had his Greek dictionary. It's not like today, where every time I go to a school board meeting in New Hampshire, they're always complaining. Oh, yes, but, some of our textbooks, they go back to the late 1970s. Oh, you might, yeah. Have the laws of physics changed since the late 1970s? We didn't think like that. So they were just passed down through the generations. And what was interesting to me is I'd read The Hobbit while I was still in whatever you call it, grade school or whatever do you call it in, I've forgotten what they call it now. Call it grade school in America, like elementary school or primary school. I was about whatever it was, 7, 8, 9 when I read The Hobbit and loved The Hobbit. And then I got to my big school and I discovered not only that J.R.R. Tolkien was an old boy, but that he was still alive, because somehow when I was reading The Hobbit, I was assuming the guy who wrote it was dead. And so I wrote a letter to Tolkien, and he very kindly replied to me. What am I talking about here? Oh, you want to know? Yeah, so there's a point to where I've sort of gone off it a bit since the films. Because now the films, it's become one of those things. It's like, for a while, everybody used to compare things to the bar scene in Star Wars. And it was funny at first. When I think the first one to do it was Rush, because he was very good at things like that. So in 1993, he said Clinton's cabinet looks like the bar scene in Star Wars. And then something else comes along. And so, you know, Lord of the Rings is one of the things that everybody compares things to, so I don't feel you need me to weigh in on that. And I must say, not when I read Lord of the Rings, but when I read some of the stuff about Lord of the Rings, I do feel rather like who was this? C.S. Lewis, Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. And he's in the pub with Tolkien and a couple of the other guys at Oxford. And they're sitting around, they're having a few pints of beer. And someone says to Tolkien, how's that book of yours going? You were telling us what happened. And he goes, and he starts explaining to them, he's just written the next chapter. And C.S. Lewis goes, oh, God, not another bleeping elf. Puts down his pint and leaves the pub. And there are moments, not with the book, but when I read some of the other commentary, that's the way I feel. Joe Crisotti says, hi, Mark. Thank you for your excellent reading of The Secret Adversary. That was our tale for our time by Agatha Christie, which wrapped up last Friday. I enjoyed that just about as much as your readings of the John Buchan novels, which have been among my favourites. Yes, we've done not only The 39 Steps, but Greenmantle, which in many ways is much more an ambitious work. We haven't yet done Mr. Stanfirst, which was the third book. And I quite like Mr. Stanfast, but I always get distracted because the minute anyone mentions Mr. Stanfast, I always want to go, Mr. Stanfast, standing so fast, you should stand slower or you'll never last. And and it's sort of, what am I on about? Anyway, at the risk of spoiling the ending for those who haven't listened through to the end, says Joe, how many secret adversaries do you think now occupy positions of power in the world today? Was the novel a work of pure fantasy for Agatha Christie when she wrote it? Or do you think she was inspired by real-world knowledge or intuition into human nature? Well, you look at it, this government is in the UK that's on the way out. The original deputy prime minister to David Cameron, because he had to have a sort of Tory liberal coalition, Nick Clegg. So that guy serves a couple of years as deputy prime minister, which I always think is a constitutionally dubious position in London, as in Ottawa, as in Canberra. But he serves a couple of years in that position. Then he gets a knighthood, and then he goes and he joins the board of Facebook. And the funny thing, or if you take Mark Carney, who was governor of the Bank of Canada, then he became governor of the Bank of England, and you think, oh yeah, well, he's been governors of national banks, that's his kind of thing, so he's governor of the Bank of Canada, then he's governor of the Bank of England, then he resigns from that, and then he's now got some gig with the World Economic Forum. And it's almost as, and it will be the same for Rishi. When Rishi is out of office on July the 5th, he'll wait a bit, and then he'll take one of these gigs with a body you might have heard of, but certainly most of the people he'll be hanging around with you won't have heard of. And it's as if being a big shot in a nation state is just some little footling little thing you have to do. Paying your dues, as we used to say. Paying your dues, having to do some footling little job running a nation state before you get to be wafted upward into the global elite. And that is actually disturbing. John Fry, I think that's how you pronounce it, although he doesn't spell it the same as Fry's chocolate cream. which I would really love right now. John Fry says, good morning, Mr. Stein. Would you please comment on the Harvard Medical School report positively linking the Moderna jab to severe brain injury events? Also, the studies adding powerful cancer-fighting agent to the list of benefits of ivermectin. Yeah, this is actually, I think the this study actually came out last year, but it seems to be doing the rounds this week because John Campbell, I think he's a doctor, has done one of his videos about it. But this study was actually done last year. And it would have been interesting, to know about it, I think, at the time. But the headline of the paper is Fatal Post-COVID mRNA Vaccine-Associated Cerebral Ischemia. And it says venous thromboses have been linked to several COVID-19 vaccines, but there is limited information on the Moderna vaccine's effect on the risk of arterial thrombosis. And I'm just pulling this up now, but it's about a lady, 30 years old, who 24 hours after receiving her first jab with the Moderna developed severe headache. 3 weeks later, she was admitted to hospital with a headache that had diminished slightly, but she was now mentally confused. And the imaging showed scattered cortical thrombosis with an elevated opening pressure on lumbar puncture. An external ventricular drain was placed. So in other words, at this point, they're actually taking part of the bone out of her skull in order to try and relieve it. But she continued to have elevated intracranial pressure. Ultimately, she required a hemicraniectomy, but intractable cerebral edema, that's, swelling, resulted in her death. She was 30, and she had had asymptomatic COVID 3 months earlier. So if we hadn't been moronized as a society, we would know that, she got this thing, she had this thing 3 months earlier, so she's got the antibodies now, right? So that even if you accept that a 30-year-old is at great risk from the COVID, which she wasn't, she doesn't need to take the thing anyway, because even if she was at risk, she's got the antibodies. But instead, she did what everybody else did, and she took it, and now she's dead, 30 years old. And that's a tragedy. And the finding was that the mRNA vaccine may have contributed to this brain swelling that killed her. And there's more and more of these things. And the problem is, there's two problems, as I said. The first one I mentioned, actually, someone asked me about Naomi Wolf. And Naomi and I talked about this on some show, because I remembered that Naomi at one time had been consulted by Bill Clinton about this and that back in the 90s. And I said, it's a bit like Clinton scandals. I said the COVID vaccines were a bit like Clinton scandals. Clinton, if you have one scandal, people can focus on it and it can be a threat to you. If you're like Clinton and you have 5,000 scandals, people just can't keep track about it. And, there's a new scandal coming along 2 days later and it's got nothing to do with any of the old scandals. It becomes very hard. And the COVID vaccines are a bit like that. They impact women's fertility. They cause heart attacks in young boys. They do the Guillain-Barré syndrome. Then they do the thing that Justin Bieber got, where his face is all weird. They do. So this is just another to the long list of things that putting this stuff in your body does to you. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's not like thalidomide or whatever. It's not, it becomes, it's much more difficult for people to get a handle on it. And I would say the other difference, after reading the Tainted Blood report, which was published in the UK, I think it was yesterday or the day before, and as I made the point that it's, if you read it, it's very much all the same people who say, oh, these anti-vaxxers, they're just conspiracy theorists, are all the ones saying, oh my God, have you read this Tainted Blood report where they the NHS, they've said the NHS infected people with hepatitis C and HIV, and then they tried to cover it up. The same people who think it's disgusting that the Tainted Blood thing was covered up for decades can't possibly imagine that anything could be iffy about, oh, well, you don't trust the Secretary of State for Health and the National Health Service, you anti-vax conspiracy theorists. Oh, my God, have you seen what the Health Secretary and the NHS did? But there's one big difference between the Tainted Blood and the vaccine thing. Is that during the Tainted Blood thing, the media, when it emerged, I remember this going back to the 80s and 90s, the Fleet Street, the newspapers and BBC, TV and radio, all kinds of people, looked into it, investigated it, drew people's attention to it. Now we have the opposite thing here, in that the media have been co-opted. The media were co-opted in advance by government, by totalitarian enforcers like Dame Melanie Dawes and Lord Grade at Ofcom. And I think that all makes it, backing off this thing, makes it actually much more difficult for them. Jeff Estes says, hi, Mark, I've heard of a new plan hatched by Western coalition members to flood the Ukraine with African immigrants in support of their war against Russia. Not sure how that would pan out. Would like to hear what you may think. Is that a serious question, Jeff? I don't think I've heard that. They are short of manpower. This is a war between two very corrupt nations, Ukraine and Russia, but it's also a war between two nations with deathbed demography, and there are far fewer Ukrainians than Russia, and they're basically running out of guys, but I haven't heard they're going to do that. I will say this, that when I was in Ukraine, the one thing I like it is that it reminded me of what European countries used to be like before the whole diversity is our strength bollocks got going. Because Ukraine was full of Ukrainians. When I was there, I didn't meet a non-Ukrainian except for this Moldovan hottie that I just found myself sitting next to at the bar in my hotel, and we fell into conversation. And I thought she was just another Ukrainian hottie, and it turned out she was actually a Moldovan hottie. But she was the only non-Ukrainian I met in Ukraine while I was there. Anyway, William Fleischman, looking at the subject from the other end, the Russian end, says, I recently wrote an article I haven't yet published about Russia's demographics. Russia's white European population has a total fertility rate of around 1.35. That's 1.3 is what demographers call the point at which you never recover. So that's what Russia's white European population has, total fertility rate of around 1.35, while its Muslim population has a total fertility rate over 2.1. I don't remember the specific numbers, but it doesn't bode well for the rest of the world. That's actually rather better than in, say, France, where the ethnic French population has a total fertility rate of about 1.3, while the French Muslim population has about 3.5. This is kids per couple, as it were. So 1.3 kids for an ethnic Russian couple whereas 2.1 kids for, say, an ethnic, a Muslim couple from Dagestan. Once a country's Muslim share of population reaches critical mass, they demand control of the public space. Wrong, William. Long before they reach critical mass, they demand control of the public space. And generally, because they're quite aggressive about it, even though in theory the majority population has the ability to resist, they cave in. Western and Central Europeans don't seem to mind that as long as they can keep their bubbles of comfort. But Russians are too poor to be that stupid. I think there will be a violent backlash in Russia against its Muslims. I think we could see in Russia something similar to the Lebanese civil war. In such a war, the Russians may still be the majority population, but the Muslims will have more young men. To make up the difference, a Russian-controlled military may resort to using chemical and nuclear weapons to even the odds, not that I mind much. Putin is a failure who will be remembered by history as a man who could have solved the country's birth rate problems with hard power and didn't. Well, we don't actually know. You know, people try. It's very difficult. As I said, once you get around 1.3, demographers feel you can't ever recover from that. And people try to bring in programs, as you know, in Viktor Orban's Hungary and things that can reverse a fall in the birth rate. But it becomes very difficult. People, I quoted this a long time ago in America Alone. I don't know whether it's still true or whether the numbers are even worse now. But 40% of female university graduates in Germany in 2006 were childless. In other words, wonderful opportunities, but there are consequences to that. There are consequences to small things. It's very difficult, for example, at a time when they're trying to force everybody into smaller and smaller cars, which they are. And at the same time, when you have things like in America, where they want the kid to be in a child seat until he's 14 years old, it's very difficult to actually have three kids in a family, because once you put these child seats in the back seat, it becomes very difficult to wedge three kids in there. So there are consequences to everything. And you're right, I think, that certain countries, like, as it appears, the United Kingdom, are going to just sleepwalk into the long Eurabian night. Other countries, like Russia, it's likely to be far bloodier and messier. This is going to be a question for a lot of people. In a very short time, I would say it's not going to be pretty what is going to be happening. Hart says, I'm not exaggerating in saying that I'm a bit fearful for you after the denouement paragraph of your wigging out essay. I pray there will be no three-lettered 3 a.m. knocks on your door. But I completely concur with your assessment, and I fear that it will soon become inescapable. This is where I said, you know, I used to say, I don't think you'll be able to vote your way out of this, which is kind of code for saying sotto voce. It's time for non-violent protest. It's time for us to start doing a Gandhi. Well, that only works. The Gandhi thing works if you're up against British civil servants. But it's not a way to bet if you're up to people who are rather more motivated about killing you. Hart says, it appears that most of the garrulous, wankerized conservative pundits continue to analyze the legal points and arguments of Trump's New York trial as if it is an actual legal proceeding instead of a Soviet-style show trial with a preordained outcome, as you have noted many times. Yeah, there's guys like Alan Dershowitz and Jonathan Turley who are super smart guys, and they're so super smart that they're looking at it as the case would be written up in one of the textbooks they teach at their respective universities. So Jonathan Turley, yeah, the judge shouldn't have done this, but this will be an excellent point to bring up on appeal. You know, I say this after 13 years in the complete toilet of the District of Columbia Superior Court. I'm not interested in fascinating legal arguments to bring up at the Supreme Court when I'm 137 years old. I'd just like my life back. And I'm not even threatened with jail like Trump. So you can read this brilliant legal analysis. You know, it's, oh, yeah, well, this corrupt judge shouldn't have done that. But it's a very strong, the appellate court will be very sympathetic. You know, some tweeter, I can't remember which tweeter this was. I think we put it in the thing this morning, but the tweeter who says Merchant doesn't care about anything of this, he just wants to the jury to criminally convict the Republican candidate for president next week, right? He wants Trump criminally convicted next week. That, of course, then raises the question, oh, does this mean he's going to be like Peter Navarro? He can announce he's appealing, but the judge then refuses to stay the judgment until the appeal is heard. So the judge, another corrupt hack judge in Peter Navarro's case, said, oh, yeah, it's fine. Yeah, you can appeal. You still have the right to appeal. But in the meantime, you're going to jail, right? So let's say Trump gets convicted by this jury next week of whatever this crime is. They still haven't said what the crime is. But it's a New York jury, so they'll convict him. And then he'll say, oh, yeah, well, my lawyers are now going to appeal this. And Judge Merchant will say, yeah, okay, but you're still going to jail. That's the world we're in. Hart continues, weird things are now happening. Biden's sudden debate challenge. Yeah, maybe Biden agreed to debate Trump because he knows that by the time of this first CNN debate, Trump is going to be behind bars. Biden's sudden debate challenge and Nikki Haley's handlers saying she will be in Milwaukee in July, just in case a new Republican candidate is needed. Will Trump receive a conviction and prison sentence next week? Asked Hart. Will a prison sentence thereby allow Biden to gloat over Trump not being able to participate in the debates? Will a Trump prison sentence allow Madam Haley to try and weasel her way into the nomination with the aid of the never-Trumpers? Timing seems important. Can Trump successfully appeal a conviction by mid-July? No. You can't do anything in an American court by mid-July. In my own case, man's lawyers missed a filing deadline to file something with the appellate court, right? And so the appellate court said, oh, no biggie, and gives him another month to do it. So the months tick by. It's an evil system, and that's why, as I said, I'm now a believer in violent revolutionary uprising, and I don't actually even care about the three-lettered 3 a.m. knocks on your door. Large parts, I can't believe that it's only 30 years since wankers of both parties used to go around droning that fake line of Alexis de Tocqueville. Oh, America is great because America is good. Does that sound remotely like anything a French aristocrat would sit down and type out? Of course not. But you used to get it from Clinton. You used to get it from America is great because America is good. Well, if you're wondering why America isn't so great right now, it's because a lot of its institutions are not good at all. They're actually evil, including large parts of the judicial system. And that is a big problem. Timothy McDonald says, musical question from the provisional wing of the Wegmans Shoppers Loyalty Program. During your upcoming vacation in London, if you could interview composer, arranger, conductor John Cameron, which of the following subjects would provide the most interesting conversation for your new music show on Serenade radio. John Cameron, that takes me back. I haven't seen John in a long time now. His work arranging and conducting the original Les Miserables concept album and all iterations of the show for many years thereafter, or his work as musical director for Hot Chocolate, which led to a song, You Sexy Thing, that went into the top 10 in three different decades, and I know you like that, or his arrangements for two Matt Monro songs, If You Go, originally Si Tu Partais for Edith Piaf, and Loving You Again by Udo Jürgens and Don Black, that once recorded, weren't released in English for several decades after recording. John Cameron has said the most fascinating thing. You know, people sort of assume that it's because he was in London that it must have been Cameron McIntosh who asked him to do Les Miserables. But no, the guys who wrote Les Miserables, Boublil and Schoenberg, Alain Boublil and Claude Michel Schoenberg, they loved his work. Alain and Claude Michel asked him in the late 70s to orchestrate the score for Les Miserables. You mentioned Hot... how does it go again? I believe in miracles. Doobie-doobie-doom-boom-boom. Where you from? You sexy thing. You sexy thing, you. Great song. I don't know where you'd... And the Matt Monro stuff. He's just super good and super versatile. He did Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven, that was used, you know, as the theme tune for Top of the Pops on the BBC for decades and decades. Yeah, I'd love to see John in. I'm all distracted now. I think it's because I'm thinking of Hot Chocolate. He was a great guy, Errol Brown, the lead singer of Hot Chocolate. Another nice guy. I think the last time I saw him was at Mort Schumann's memorial service. We had a chat there afterwards. But anyway, I thank you for all your questions. Christine Page says, this boomer is an operetta fan, for which I credit my dear mom, without whose blessed influence I doubt I'd ever have even heard of Rodgers and Hammerstein, let alone Sigmund Romberg. She was a devoted fan of Jeanette Donald and Nelson Eddy and Mario Lanza. As a consequence, my little boys were treated to the drinking song from the Student Prince at bath time. Our memory. Drink, drink, drink. Raise your stein and drink your beer. Not me. Put me down. It's not that kind of stein they're talking about, for heaven's sake. Jeanette MacDonald and Nelson. I had these contractors working on the house year in, year out. And one time I was just absent-mindedly singing, by a waterfall I'm calling you. And Scott, who was one of the carpenters working in the next room, came in and said, my mother had Jeanette MacDonald's record of that. She used to play it all the time. I hate that song. So obviously, for the however many years they were still working on the house, I used to sing, by a waterfall I'm calling you. In Jeanette MacDonald's key, just to annoy him. What do I do? We're wandering too far afield. Me doing my Jeanette MacDonald impression, by the way, is the only music you're going to get, because, as I said, we've moved all the music to Saturday, Serenade Radio, 5 p.m. London time. That's 6 p.m. if you happen to be in Albania, or 12 noon if you happen to be in the Eastern time zone of North America. I hope you'll join me this weekend for a little more operetta. People seem to like our first three shows, and I think they'll like this one. That'll do it for today, though. Stick with Stein Online for our regular Thursday date with Laura's Links. Laura Rosenkahn will round up the internet as only she can on Friday. We shall have a new tale for our time. Don't miss it. And if you're still toying with the pros and cons of joining the Mark Stein Club, come on in. The water's fine. And don't forget, for the Stein-shy chum in your life, There's a Mark Stein Club gift membership with his or her name on it. Stay safe, stay free, stay well, stay out of court.
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.